immigrant advocacy group, Race Forward. The group claimed that the term was always considered an epithet, but had been recently revived by anti-immigration groups intent on dehumanizing illegals. This assertion was repeated, without correction, by the New York Times in a November 2014 article that objectively reported, "The term illegal immigrant is a tactical term promoted by anti-immigration groups starting in the mid-2000s. Like everything else printed in the Times about immigration, this is a lie. The first use of illegal immigrant in the Nexus archives is from August 29, 1969, in, of all places, the New York Times. That's as far back as the Nexus archives go. The Times alone used the phrase illegal immigrant more than 3,000 times before 1990, 3,000 being the number at which Nexus stops counting. It took approximately 60 seconds to run that search, and I paused for a drink of water." But Times reporter Julie Turkowitz blandly repeated the absurd statement that the phrase illegal immigrant was popularized by anti-immigration groups in the mid-2000s as a dehumanizing epithet, without considering whether Times readers might remember what happened yesterday. At least the AP and the Times try to shut down debate with words, albeit lies. Illegal immigrants from the Third World prefer to make their point with violence. Any newspaper that dares use the term illegal alien can expect to have its offices vandalized, as happened to the Santa Barbara News Press's offices in January 2015. Local police had been braced for an attack on the News Press's offices because illegal immigrants don't like being called illegal immigrants and tend to express themselves with mob protests, in the grand tradition of John Stuart Mill. What words can we use? The media also render discussion of anchor babies beyond the pale by banning all words necessary to discuss the phenomenon. Quoting a California nurse who said she had delivered hundreds of anchor babies, the New York Times quickly added that she was using a derisive term to describe children whose parents did not hold citizenship. This is how the Times treats all subjects it would frankly prefer that we not discuss. The paper has an auto key for partial birth abortion, for example, reading, "a procedure referred to by its opponents as partial birth abortion." Okay, the Times doesn't like that name. What name does the Times like? It won't tell us. And what would the Times call a baby whose birth in America allows all the child's relatives to stay? It's not birthright citizenship. That would include legal aliens, who don't need a baby to stay in the country, but whose U.S.-born children are automatically citizens. The behavior anchor baby refers to is the fraud of illegal aliens giving birth at U.S. hospitals, thus anchoring an entire extended family to the United States by virtue of the child's auto-citizenship. There's no logical reason for the whole family to come here. But we get wails of, "You're trying to separate us from our American citizen child." No one ever considers the possibility that the family could also stay together by going back to their own country. This is the way immigration law is abused with family reunification policies, also known as chain migration, or as the Times would put it, a derisive term to describe remote villages relocating to America on the basis of a single villager's U.S. citizenship. Justice Brennan's footnote gave us anchor babies. Anchor babies are citizens only because of a phony constitutional principle cooked up by Justice William Brennan in 1982. Just like abortion, sodomy, gay marriage, and unicorns, it's in the Constitution. If Americans want to be generous enough to provide for millions upon millions of illegal aliens, they ought to at least be asked. Instead, the taxpayers are forced to support foreign-born poor through a legal fiction, and are called racist if they ask any questions. Americans are smugly informed that the 14th Amendment confers U.S. citizenship on anyone who was born in the United States. Liberals act as if this amendment was added to the Constitution in an early burst of multicultural sentiment so that La Raza could come along a century later and make millions of foreigner citizens without the consent of the people. "Look, we've got to make sure that no matter how people get here, their children will be American citizens." Are you kidding me? That's not already in the Constitution? Most people are too cowed to ask the obvious question. Why would Americans have done that? They didn't. Automatic citizenship for anyone born in the United States was invented out of whole cloth by Justice Brennan and slipped into a footnote in a 1982 Supreme Court case. It's so crazy that even Senator Harry Reid knows it's crazy. In 1993, Reid introduced a bill that would clearly end citizenship for the children of illegal aliens. As he explained, if making it easy to be an illegal alien isn't enough, how about offering a reward for being an illegal immigrant? No sane country would do that, right? Guess again. If you break our laws by entering this country without permission and give birth to a child, we reward that child with U.S. citizenship and guarantee full access to all public and social services this society provides. And that's a lot of services. Is it any wonder that two-thirds of the babies born at taxpayer expense in county-run hospitals in Los Angeles are born to illegal alien mothers? Noting that the false promise of citizenship was luring pregnant alien women to enter the United States illegally, Reid said his bill simply clarified that anyone born in the United States to an illegal alien mother is not a U.S. citizen. But then Democrats discovered that the parents of the anchor babies were voting for them. Suddenly, Senator Reid decided it wasn't insane to give citizenship to children born to illegals after all. To the contrary, it was racist not to do so. Appellate court judge Richard Posner, the most cited federal judge, wrote a concurring opinion in a 2003 case for the sole purpose of asking Congress to rethink awarding citizenship to everyone born in the United States. Justice Brennan's invented constitutional right, he said, was luring illegal immigrants whose sole motive in immigrating was to confer U.S. citizenship on their as-yet unborn children. Referring contemptuously to the idea that citizenship by birth is compelled by the 14th Amendment, he asked Congress to pass a law and put an end to the nonsense. Abraham Lincoln freed the Mexicans. Just so everyone knows the facts, the 14th Amendment was part of the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War, passed in response to the South's sleazy attempts to deny freed blacks their rights, over which a bloody war had just been fought. To get a constitutional amendment passed, there has to be a mass feeling about a big problem. It isn't a secret trapdoor put in the Constitution for fun. The sole and exclusive purpose of the 14th Amendment was to stop Democrats from nullifying the entire Civil War by continuing to deny citizenship rights to the newly freed slaves. The idea was not to ensure that every pregnant Mexican who runs across the border would win citizenship for a child born here. That's weird that women who are 8.5 months pregnant suddenly want to go on an arduous trip to another country. Wouldn't you rather wait until you have the baby? Oh, I see. Even the former Ku Klux Klanner on the court, Justice Hugo Black, admitted that the sole purpose of the 14th Amendment was to protect freed slaves. In a widely ridiculed 1898 case, United States versus Wong Kim Ark, the Supreme Court ruled that the children born to legal immigrants in the United States were citizens. As the dissent, legal commentators, and the Yale Law Journal pointed out at the time, the majority opinion had based its ruling on British feudal law, forgetting that America had pretty forcefully rejected Britain's ideas about a king. As ridiculous as it was for the Wong Kim Ark Court to grant citizenship to the children of legal immigrants, that's how the law stood for 84 years. And then, out of the blue, during the Reagan administration, Justice Brennan slipped a footnote into a 5-4 decision in Plyler v. Doe, asserting that no plausible distinction could be drawn between resident aliens whose entry into the United States was lawful and resident aliens whose entry was unlawful. I can think of a few plausible distinctions. For one, there's the lawful versus unlawful part. Also, legal immigrants, in theory, have been looked over by the country's immigration officials and approved for permanent residency. Legal immigrants, all of whom will now have access to taxpayer-funded Obamacare, have been checked for contagious diseases, insanity, mental defects. Again, this is in theory. The Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons reports that many illegal aliens harbor fatal diseases that American medicine fought and vanquished long ago, such as drug-resistant tuberculosis, malaria, leprosy, plague, polio, dengue, and Chagas disease. Brennan's only authority for the drivel about there being no plausible distinction between the children of legal immigrants and illegal aliens was a 1912 book written by Clement L. Bouvet. Bouvet was not a senator, nor an elected official, and certainly not a judge. He was just some guy who wrote a book. So on one hand, we have the history, the objective, the plain meaning, the author's intent, and more than a century of law on the 14th Amendment. On the other hand, we have the idle ramblings of Clement, whom I'm guessing was too cheap to hire an American housekeeper. And what a boon anchor babies have been to America. Combine Justice Brennan's footnote with America's ludicrously generous welfare policies, and America may as well have a sign on the border that says, "Free money." Consider the cost of just one family of illegal immigrants attached to America by its anchor babies. As reported in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons, the Silverios from Stockton, California, are illegal aliens. Cristobal Silverio came here illegally from Oxtotlan, Mexico, in 1997 and brought his wife Felipa, plus three children, aged 19, 12, and 8. Felipa gave birth to a new daughter, her anchor baby, named Flor. Flor was premature, spent 3 months in the neonatal incubator, and cost San Joaquin Hospital more than $300,000. Meanwhile, Felipa's oldest daughter, Lourdes, plus her illegal alien husband, produced their own anchor baby, Esmeralda. Grandma Felipa created a second anchor baby, Christian. Anchor babies are valuable. A disabled anchor baby is more valuable than a healthy one. The two Silverio anchor babies generate $1,000 per month in public welfare funding. Flora gets $600 per month for asthma. Healthy Christian gets $400. Cristobal and Felipa last year earned $18,000 picking fruit. Flor and Christian were paid $12,000 for being anchor babies. This illegal alien family's annual income tops $30,000. Cristobal Silverio, when drunk one Saturday night, crashed his van. Though he had no auto insurance or driver's license and owed thousands of dollars, he easily bought another van. Stockton police say that 44% of all hit and runs are by illegal aliens. If Chris had been seriously injured, the EMTALA associated entitlement would provide, as it did for the 4-year rehabilitation of a quadriplegic neighbor illegal alien. Rehabilitation costs customarily do not fall under the title emergency care, but partisans clamor to keep paraplegics in America rather than deport them to more primitive facilities south of the border. In 2003, 70% of the 2,300 babies born in Stockton's San Joaquin General Hospital's maternity ward were anchor babies. By 2013, Stockton was bankrupt. Any politician who opposed our insane anchor baby policy would be smugly denounced by the New York Times and wouldn't lose a single vote. Granting citizenship to the children of illegal aliens has turned American citizenship into a game of Red Rover with the Border Patrol. The anchor baby foolishness takes this country's immigration policy completely out of Americans' hands and puts it into the hands of foreigners. It would make as much sense to allow Mexican migrant workers to decide when America goes to war. As Chief Justice Fuller quaintly wrote in Wong Kim Ark, "Nobody can deny that the question of citizenship in a nation is of the most vital importance. It is a precious heritage as well as an inestimable acquisition." Not anymore. Now anyone can get American citizenship. The Somali warlord Hussein Mohammed Adid was an American citizen. The foreign minister of Bosnia-Herzegovina in the 1990s was an American citizen. The president of Lithuania was an American citizen and an employee of the U.S. government at the same time. The head of the Estonian army was an American citizen. Iraq's ambassador to the United States in 2003 was an American citizen. A slew of Islamic terrorists are American citizens, such as Al-Qaeda operative Anwar al-Awlaki and his son Abdul Rahman. You can read about the younger Alla Locky's mop of curly hair and wide, goofy smile in the New York Times op-ed, "The Drone That Killed My Grandson," by Nasser al-Awlaki. The amnesty pushers have beautiful homes, beachfront property, European vacations, Senate offices, vast portfolios, influence with the Harvard Admissions Committee, and powerful friends in the media and politics. What do they care about American citizenship? But for most Americans, our most precious possession is citizenship in this amazing country. That endowment is being bartered away by our elites in exchange for votes, for profits, or for campaign dollars. America to pollsters, we surrender. Although we've been authoritatively informed that a majority of Americans support a pathway to citizenship approximately 500 times in the last 2 years alone, according to a quick Nexus search, that is a lie. This is part of the media's campaign to convince Americans they're nuts for preferring not to turn America into Mexico. Polls are irrelevant if you lie to the people being polled. Poll: do you support common sense gun safety, or are you against it? Headline: majority of Americans support gun control. But I hate gun control. Too late, you agreed to common sense gun safety. That means gun control. Similarly, polls purporting to show a majority of Americans supporting a pathway to citizenship invariably offer choices that are not on the table, that no one has proposed, and that do not exist in any piece of legislation. The amnesty option is always loaded up with imaginary hurdles that illegal aliens will have to clear. Learning English, passing citizenship tests, and paying fines, fees, and back taxes. The non-amnesty option always seems to entail rounding up 11 million illegal aliens, putting them on buses, and deporting them. Neither of these choices describes the position of anyone on either side of the immigration debate. Amnesty proponents have no intention of making illegals jump through any hoops whatsoever to become citizens, and not a single amnesty opponent has proposed any program to round up and deport 11 million illegal aliens. Maybe just one, if you count me. This is how the left uses polls to manipulate public opinion, rather than quantify it. They provide the ingredients for today's political discussion, and you're not allowed to choose any items off the menu. But can't I be against amnesty without voting for rounding up illegals at gunpoint? No, look at the menu. No substitutions. Brookings poll: would you prefer a unicorn or a Loch Ness monster? Typical is a Brookings Institution poll, asking respondents to choose one of two imaginary options. The best way to solve the country's illegal immigration problem is to secure our borders and arrest and deport all those who are here illegally. Or, the best way to solve the country's illegal immigration problems is to both secure our borders and provide an earned path to citizenship for illegal immigrants already in the U.S. Absolutely no one has proposed that we deport all those who are here illegally, much less arrest them. No one. Mitt Romney had the toughest stance against illegal immigration of any major presidential candidate since Dwight Eisenhower, and he only suggested encouraging illegal immigrants to self-deport, i.e., go back the same way they came. We didn't round them up to get them here, and we don't have to round them up to get them home. As for the Brookings poll's second option, both secure our borders and provide an earned path to citizenship, there's no both. There's no border security ever, and there's no earned path either. It's no strings attached legalization now and vague promises of border security later. Poll: what ice cream do you prefer, delicious chocolate or three-day-old raw squid? Headline: chocolate, America's favorite ice cream flavor. Marco Rubio went on a worldwide tour swearing that his comprehensive immigration reform absolutely insisted on enforcement first. Then the bill was unveiled and it said, Step 1, everyone who came here illegally is legal. Step 2, after they're amnestied, they can bring in all their relatives. So Rubio's plan, approved by a majority of the Senate, including 14 Republicans, was dessert first, then we all agree, no more dessert. We'll start the diet tomorrow. When would the enforcement part of Rubio's enforcement first plan have kicked in? Answer: Never. As Rubio said on Fox News Sunday, basically, Homeland Security will have 5 years to meet that goal. If after 5 years, Homeland Security has not met that number, it will trigger the Border Commission, who will then take over this issue for them. So if the Department of Homeland Security failed to secure the border, another government commission would be created. That always works, said the Department of Education. And if the second commission failed, Rubio would personally write a strongly worded letter. Would the 11 million illegals already legalized lose that status if the border remained wide open? Of course not. Refer to step one. But the bill sure would have spent a lot of taxpayer money. Wall Street Journal poll. Or how about a Sasquatch? In November 2014, a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll asked respondents if they would support a proposed pathway to citizenship that allowed foreigners who have jobs but are staying illegally in the United States the opportunity to eventually become legal American citizens if they pay a fine, any back taxes, pass a security background check, and take other required steps. After the word foreigners, everything in that poll question is pure fantasy. Let's start with staying illegally in the United States. We're talking about people who sneaked into the country by hiring smugglers, wading through the Rio Grande, and hiding in truck beds. They traveled through remote desert locations in the dead of night, fled from U.S. agents, and stole American IDs. They broke the law, and look me in the eye, illegal aliens, they know they broke the law. But at the Wall Street Journal, how they got here is a complete mystery. Maybe we dragged them across the border. All we know is, right now, they are staying illegally in the United States. Perhaps if what illegals did to get here were not hidden from poll respondents, it would seem less draconian to propose that they go home the same way. The return trip would be a lot easier. Moreover, all that stuff about jobs, fines, and taxes is utter nonsense. I know it, the Wall Street Journal knows it, and the Mexicans hurtling toward our border with the speed of cannonballs know it. But it convinces Americans who aren't paying attention that we're only going to get the most diligent illegals. Not only that, but we're going to make all kinds of money off of amnesty. The last amnesty was loaded up with fines, fees, back taxes, and English lessons for illegal aliens. Let's review how that panned out. English language requirement dropped by the INS. Fines dropped by the INS. Fees waived by the INS. Back taxes dropped by the IRS. Rubio's amnesty didn't even contain the promises of the Reagan amnesty. The only fee in Rubio's bill was defined as the actual cost to the government to process an illegal immigrant's application. Who else is supposed to pay for that? In fact, however, you will, taxpayer. The bill allowed the INS commissioner to waive the fee for any reason. The INS already waives fees for illegal immigrants who are on government assistance, which is 71% of them. We want no delay in legalizing the neediest immigrants. The alleged fine has enough exceptions to ensure that no one ever pays it. The law provides that any illegal alien currently under the age of 21 is exempted, but so are illegal immigrants of any age who merely have a GED and assert that they came to the United States before age 16. As we know from Reagan's amnesty, when nearly 1 million illegal immigrants falsely claimed to have been farm workers to get amnesty, foreigners who have already broken U.S. laws are not always punctilious about telling the truth to government officials. Under the Special Agricultural Amnesty of the 1986 bill, the INS received nearly 100,000 applications from farm workers living in the lush, fertile farmland of New York City. Another 100,000 applications were mailed in directly from Mexico. Some farm workers told agents that cotton was purple or described pulling cherries from the ground. Within the first 3 years of the agricultural worker amnesty, the government identified nearly 900,000 fraudulent applications, of which it approved more than 800,000. And consider that the age at which someone who was living in the shadows first began living in the shadows is a lot easier to fake than prior farm work. True, any wealthy illegal immigrants would be required to pay back taxes. Unfortunately, there are no wealthy illegal immigrants. Half of Americans don't pay income taxes. No illegal immigrant will. That leaves only Social Security taxes. We're always told that we need to amnesty illegals to shore up Social Security. How exactly are people who make so little money that they don't pay income taxes going to save Social Security? If we had an adversarial press, or even a curious press, it would ask, will immigrants be paying in as much as they take out? No, they won't. So that makes it worse, right? Why, yes, it does. I only hoped you would not ask that question. Under Rubio's bill, illegal immigrants weren't even required to pay their back Social Security taxes. Instead, the IRS was directed to collect only those taxes already assessed. Guess how Social Security taxes are assessed against people without valid Social Security cards? They aren't. Even before the INS commissioner starts waiving payments, illegal aliens owe 0.00 in back taxes. Rubio's bill could have required employers to calculate the Social Security taxes illegal aliens owed, but that idea was expressly rejected by Senate negotiators in early 2013. Amnesty supporters complained that it was just too hard to collect back taxes from illegal aliens. As Senator Jeff Flake explained, getting back taxes is incredibly difficult, particularly when someone has paid into a fraudulent Social Security number. Okay, fine. Then how about dropping poll questions claiming that illegal aliens will be paying back taxes? The Journal poll was taken in the fall of 2014, more than a year after the Senate bill had explicitly dropped the possibility of collecting back taxes from illegal aliens. But the question polled not only implied that illegal aliens would pay back taxes, but claimed that that particular question gave respondents more details about the proposal. Not any proposal on planet Earth. 30 million needy immigrants, surprisingly not good for the economy. Somehow, the idea that the mass importation of poor people is good for the economy has caught on like a runaway train. Everyone agrees. These claims refer to the size of the entire economy, which inevitably expands the more humans we have living here. So does your household budget if I move into your extra bedroom. The cost of your electricity, cable TV, water, food, newspaper subscriptions, Netflix subscription, and overdue books will go through the roof. But don't worry, I'll be writing you a check for $250 a month. Unfortunately, I will be eating $400 worth of food every month. So the size of your household GNP has increased, but you aren't ahead of the game. I am ahead of the game. The entire benefit is captured by moi. It's the exact same math with any immigrant to America who does not pay in taxes more than he gets back in government services. That includes not only assistance programs, but also schools, highways, police, hospitals, and so on. Thus, a more detailed breakdown of the costs and benefits shows that college-educated Americans pay an average of $29,000 more in taxes every year than they get back in government services, according to an analysis by the Heritage Foundation's Robert Rector. By contrast, legal immigrants, on average, get back $4,344 more in government services than they pay in taxes. Those with only a high school degree net about $14,642 in government payments, and those without a high school degree collect a whopping $36,993. Contrary to the claims of Senator Chuck Schumer's press secretary, Marco Rubio, making illegal alien citizens will not result in the U.S. Treasury being deluged with their tax payments. The vast majority of illegal aliens, about 75%, have only a high school diploma or less, so legalization means they will immediately begin collecting an average of $14,642 to $36,993 per year from the U.S. taxpayer. Even worse, under Rubio's bill and Obama's executive action, amnesty to illegal aliens immediately collect a windfall directly from the U.S. Treasury in missed earned income tax credits. So the definition for paying back taxes under Rubio's bill was receiving welfare. Of course, with 71% of illegal alien households already on government assistance, paying back taxes means getting even more welfare than you do currently, illustrating the principle that in matters of great importance, the difference between evil and stupidity is irrelevant. Marco Rubio stoutly asserted that under his bill, amnesty to illegal immigrants don't qualify for any federal benefits. A huge majority, 71%, were already collecting federal benefits when he said that, and were on track to collect a lot more welfare had his bill become law. Can we retake the Wall Street Journal's poll, but this time inquire about the only pathway to citizenship proposed or passed by either House of Congress? Would you support a pathway to citizenship for illegal immigrants who knowingly broke this country's laws that would allow them to immediately collect past welfare payments they lost out on while working off the books? California's field poll, electrocution or a warm puppy? When it comes to immigration polls, the Brookings Institutions and the Wall Street Journals are two of the more honest ones. California's field poll asked respondents if they support having federal immigration agents round up, detain, and deport immigrants found to be living here illegally, or if they would support a proposal to create a program that would allow illegal immigrants who have been living in the U.S. for a number of years an opportunity to stay in this country and apply for citizenship if they have a job, learned English, and paid back taxes. There's no program for allowing illegals an opportunity to stay and pay back taxes. The plan is to legalize illegal aliens immediately without regard to how long they've been here, much less whether they have a job, speak English, or will ever pay one penny in taxes. Nonetheless, more poll respondents, 46%, favored having federal immigration agents round up, detain, and deport immigrants found to be living here illegally than were opposed to that policy, 43%. Polls that neglect to stack the deck with lies on both sides of the equation never come out so well for mass immigration advocates. The pro-amnesty technology website, TechCrunch, for example, forgot to ask about the non-existent hurdles for illegal immigrants and ask only about the non-existent proposal to deport 11 million people. The question polled was, do you support or oppose deporting the 11 million undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S.? Again, no politician has proposed any program to deport 11 million illegal aliens. So the TechCrunch poll was biased, but only by half. Still, a majority of respondents, 53.4%, supported mass deportation, compared with 42% opposed. Among Republicans, 74.1% chose the deport 11 million option, with only 22.3% opposed. And that's what Americans say after years of relentless media propaganda. Where was the word amnesty in the TechCrunch poll? That's what we're talking about, not some imaginary plan to round up illegals and deport them. With immigration polls, there's never a no button. The only question is, do you want more immigration, or do you want a lot more immigration? There's no place to write in. How about none? The people feverishly hiding the truth from the public are perfectly aware that they are completely transforming this country. They cheer the end of America. Chapter 4. The Lie. There's no such thing as America. Americans seem to be under the misimpression that they don't have a country at all, but rather live in something like the international waiting room at JFK Airport. America is not a nation of immigrants. It is not an idea. It was never diverse, and diversity is a catastrophe. If America were an idea, every country on earth could be America. Electricity is an idea. The airplane is an idea. Washing with soap is an idea. That's why other countries have been able to adopt those innovations. No other country on earth has been able to approximate America, except our fellow Anglo-Saxon nations. Why is that? We've been dropping enormous hints to the rest of the world for centuries. America is not a mere landmass. Otherwise, the Indians would have written the Declaration of Independence and put a man on the moon. Far from discovering America, Indians didn't even detect America. There was no America until the British and Dutch arrived. They were not immigrants, because there was no established society for them to move to. Without the white settlers, what is known as America would still be an unnamed continent full of migratory tribes chasing the rear end of a buffalo every time their stomachs growled. America's crime of non-diversity. At a swearing-in ceremony for new immigrants in the summer of 2014, the Harvard-educated First Lady, Michelle Obama, said, "It's amazing that just a few feet from here, where I'm standing, are the signatures of the 56 founders who put their names on a declaration that changed the course of history. And like the 50 of you, none of them were born in America. They became American." That's if you don't count the 48 of 56 who were born in America. The other 8, like the rest of them, were either British or Dutch. 55 were Protestant. Only 1 was Catholic. There's a reason King George called the American Revolution a Presbyterian War. The single document in Nexus's news archives to report the First Lady's jaw-droppingly ignorant remark about the signers of America's Declaration of Independence did so in order to proclaim her correct. Yes, Snopes.com said Mrs. Obama was correct in the sense that the Founding Fathers were not born into a fully formed and established America with its own history, customs, culture, and values, as modern American children are. That's if you don't count the 85% of the Declaration signers who were born into a fully formed and established America with its own history, customs, culture, and values. The American colonies had been around for about 150 years at that point. Not only the signers of the Declaration, but the first 17 presidents were all born in one of the original 13 colonies. The 18th was Ulysses Grant, who was born in Ohio. The vast majority of U.S. presidents were exclusively of British or Dutch descent. There has not been a single one without at least some British ancestry. Not one. The few recent presidents with exotic ethnicities were Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt, who were part French, in addition to British and Dutch. Herbert Hoover, who was Swiss and German, in addition to British. Dwight Eisenhower, who was German and Swiss, in addition to British. Richard Nixon, who was part German, in addition to British. George H.W. and W. Bush, who are also part German, in addition to British and Dutch. And Barack Obama, who was part Kenyan, in addition to British. No Swedes, no Finns, no Ukrainians, and certainly no Salvadorans or Chinese. The entire British Isles, plus the Netherlands, covers a geographic area smaller than Japan. If 83% of American presidents had been exclusively Japanese, and 100% were at least part Japanese, would we talk about America being a nation of immigrants? Every single president except Kennedy was a Protestant. Recent Democratic presidents were, of course, atheists, but all except JFK professed to be Protestants. Argentina has had a president who was of 100% Syrian ethnicity, Carlos Saúl Menem. The prime minister of Belgium was Italian, Elio Di Rupo. Peru has had a Japanese president, Alberto Fujimori. Britain had a Jewish prime minister, all of whose grandparents were born in Italy, Benjamin Disraeli. No one calls these countries nations of immigrants. America has never had a president who wasn't, at least in part, of British ancestry, but people still babble that we're a nation of immigrants. For 100 years before the signing of the Declaration, and 100 years after, America was extraordinarily undiverse in ethnicity, British, Dutch, West African, and Germanic, in religious practice, overwhelmingly Protestant, 98% Christian, in language, English, and in cultural mores, no wailing at funerals or child rape. Even the few French settlers in colonial America were Protestants. They had fled France under threat of forced conversion to Catholicism. Pre-revolutionary America allowed the naturalization of Jews, but not Catholics. Curiously, in contemporary America, Hispanic Protestants are majority Republican, while Hispanic Catholics are nearly monolithically Democrat. Harvard professor Samuel Huntington asks, "Would America be the America it is today if in the 17th and 18th centuries it had been settled not by British Protestants, but by French, Spanish, or Portuguese Catholics? Clearly not. It would not be America. It would be Quebec, Mexico, or Brazil. Author Richard Brookhiser writes, "The WASP character is the American character. It is the mold, the template, the archetype, the set of axes along which the crystal has grown. Without the WASP, it would be another country altogether." For its 1976 bicentennial edition, Time magazine tried to cover up the Founding Fathers' crime of non-diversity by making them look less WASPy. A photo display of 11 descendants of the founders included Yukiko Irwin, born and raised in Japan, and an African-American probation officer, Elmer Roberts, allegedly descended from Thomas Jefferson's non-existent sexual relationship with slave Sally Hemings. Time wanted to make absolutely clear that the United States was not the product of a bunch of Protestant Anglo-Saxon men, if that's what you were thinking. Except the problem is, it was. And the country remained overwhelmingly Anglo-Saxon and Protestant right up until Teddy Kennedy decided to change it. A nation of immigrants is not a nation. Contrary to PC nonsense about America being a diverse melting pot, America has never been a nation of immigrants. Most Americans have always been born here. Even as late as 1990, a quarter century into Teddy Kennedy's scheme to remake the nation, half of the American population traced its roots to the black and white populace of 1790. Nearly the entire white population of America, from 1600 to 1970, came from a geographic area of the world about twice the size of Texas. The entire black population came from an area of West Africa about the size of Florida. Until Teddy Kennedy struck, America was never less than 99% white Western European and West African black. That's biracial, not diverse. African Americans are every bit as much a part of Anglo-Saxon America as the Anglo-Saxons themselves. Cheap labor enthusiasts love to insult black workers with fulsome tributes to hard-working immigrants doing jobs Americans, wink wink, just won't do. But you cannot understand America without talking about blacks. America is the only country to fight a revolution based on the principle that all men are equal before God, and it is the only country to fight a bloody civil war to end slavery and redeem that promise. African Americans' contributions to the nation's wars, and especially to its culture, make this country what it is. Blacks served with one of the most important outfits in the American Revolution, John Glover's Marblehead Regiment, which provided the Continental Army with its first naval ship and also stood guard at General George Washington's personal headquarters. In 1775 America, General Glover was perfectly at home with black Americans, who served aboard vessels in Marblehead's fishing fleet, lived in the same town that he did, and even attended the same church. The Civil War might have ended differently if so many blacks hadn't fled their Confederate masters, including the inspirational abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass, or without free blacks fighting with the Union Army. Black Americans fought bravely in both World Wars, even in an army kept segregated by part French FDR. In addition to fighting its wars and helping shape its history, black Americans have an outsized influence on the nation's style, the Christianity, the slang, the music. For half a century, every rock group in the world aspired to sound like Chuck Berry. No one has ever wanted to sound like a mariachi band. The nation's most pressing social problems, principally illegitimacy, are also disproportionately black problems. Imagine if all the resources lavished on immigrants had gone to American blacks. Two centuries after the first Europeans settled America, the white population was 80% British and 98% Protestant. A century after that, the populace was still overwhelmingly English-speaking, British, and Protestant, but for an exciting change also included Germans and Scandinavians. The colorful immigrants at the turn of the 19th century were wildly different from the original settlers, in the sense that they were white people from a different part of Western Europe. For vibrancy, America had the Puerto Ricans, whom President Woodrow Wilson made citizens in 1917, because Democrats needed bodies to fight World War I, and employers needed, guess what? That's correct, cheap labor. By 1970, fewer than 1 million Puerto Ricans lived in the United States. My, our post-welfare state immigrants have changed. The entire time it was processing immigrants, from 1892 until 1954, Ellis Island received only 12 million immigrants. Please stop weeping about your grandfathers arriving at Ellis Island. It's irritating, and it bears absolutely no relationship to immigration today. Earlier immigrants proved their hardiness by vomiting all the way across the Atlantic Ocean to get here. There was no welfare, and certainly no welcoming committees of ethnic grievance groups. People weren't allowed to come to America and just hang out. Towns provided for their own infirm and elderly, and they definitely didn't want deadbeats wandering over from the next town. In 1797, for example, Vermont state law required each community to prevent the poor, resident within their respective towns or places, from strolling into any other town or place. When a new family showed up, the town clerk would promptly investigate. And if it looked as if the newcomers might become a burden, the family would be sent a warning out letter telling them to leave. About a third of pre-1965 immigrants went home, except British and Jewish immigrants, less than 10% of whom returned. Now no one goes home. They go on welfare. Today's immigrants aren't coming here to breathe free. They're coming to live for free. Most of them wouldn't come at all if they had to survive in the work-or-die America that existed when we got all those relatives being wept over. What are Mexico's policies on that? If my money runs out and I have a few kids with my equally non-Mexican boyfriend, do we get free money from Mexican taxpayers? What about the babies? They didn't do anything wrong. Today, any immigrants who didn't come expressly for the welfare have the Ford Foundation to acquaint them with their rights. If the Ford Foundation is busy, there's always the National Council of La Raza, George Soros's Open Society Foundations, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Migration Policy Institute, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, the National Immigration Law Center, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, the American Bar Association's Commission on Immigration Policy, all working to transfer money from the American taxpayer to poverty-stricken immigrants from primitive cultures. Not only are immigrants taught to live off the American taxpayer, but they are counseled in resentment toward their benefactors. The vast majority of children of Mexican, Filipino, Haitian, Vietnamese, Laotian, and Jamaican immigrants complain about being discriminated against. We take fewer immigrants from Britain than from any of these countries except Haiti, Laos, and Jamaica, all of which have populations about the same size as, or much smaller than, the city of London. Darfur is the natural state of the world. America is not the natural state of the world. The natural state of the world is Darfur. The British Empire spread Anglo-Saxon culture around the globe. Protestant morals, individualism, and the rule of law. Most British colonies rejected those values. Only the ones populated by actual British people, America, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, managed to hold on to them and, as a result, prospered. The empire's most successful experiment was the United States. Anyone who hesitates for a moment to recognize that some groups have it over other groups in producing free and prosperous nations has been brainwashed beyond reclamation. The UPI Syndicate puts out a weekly almanac column listing important world events that happened on given dates in other years. I happened to come across the one for the week of April 9 and noticed something about the rest of the world. From UPI. In 1992, a federal jury in Miami convicted deposed Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega on cocaine trafficking charges. In 1997, a government of unity was launched in Angola, 3 years after the end of the country's 19-year civil war, with the seating of 70 members of the rebel UNITA Party in parliament. In 1999, the president of the African nation of Niger was assassinated, reportedly by members of his own guard. A military junta led by the commander of the presidential guards took over. In 2000, Peru's president, Alberto Fujimori, failed to win a first-round election victory, forcing a runoff in May, which he won. However, a vote fraud scandal forced him to step down later in the year. In 2003, the mood in Iraq became exuberant as Iraqis, with help from Americans, toppled a 20-foot statue of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad's Firdaus Square. In 2004, authorities in Bulgaria said at least 40 people were injured, some seriously, in a toxic gas attack on a police station in Sofia. While most of the rest of the globe is a cesspool of civil war, revolution, drug dealing, military coups, and assassinations, UPI's almanac entries for America are things like First American to Circumnavigate the Globe, 1790, and William Hunt of New York patented the safety pin, 1847. Immediately following an entry for 1916, Professional Golfers Association of America was founded, is this one. In 1919, Emiliano Zapata, a leader of peasants and indigenous people during the Mexican Revolution, was ambushed and killed in Morelos by government forces. And that particular week was short on Muslim entries, thus avoiding any noteworthy beheadings. That's how the list looked until fairly recently, anyway. Lately, the almanac has been acquiring events in America like this one. In 2006, an estimated 500,000 people protested in Los Angeles against proposed U.S. legislation that would make it a felony to be in the United States illegally. Thanks to our new We Assimilate to Them strategy, angry immigrants seem to be in a constant state of protest. After Professor Huntington wrote a book warning that America could not survive the cultural onslaught from Latin America, Hispanics responded with a flurry of scholarly papers and academic critiques countering his thesis. Just kidding. They called for national protests against Huntington, his publisher, and Harvard University. These are not the descendants of the Magna Carta. Edmund Burke, Britain's most eloquent defender of the American Revolution, attributed Americans' love of freedom expressly to the dual facts that they were British and they were Protestants. First, the people of the colonies are descendants of Englishmen. They are, therefore, not only devoted to liberty, but to liberty according to English ideas and on English principles. The people are Protestants, and of that kind which is the most averse to all implicit submission of mind and opinion. This is a persuasion not only favorable to liberty, but built upon it. As Huntington says, all religions come to America and become Protestant. Catholics, for example, were not fully accepted into American society until the church became less Roman Catholic and more American Catholic. Earlier immigrants were champs at assimilation. Obviously, members of other ethnic groups can be great Americans, but that doesn't mean America is an idea. It means America's distinctively British Protestant culture can be acquired. Earlier immigrants were, as a rule, fantastic assimilators. While WASPs seem embarrassed about their own culture, Jewish Americans have taken to it with gusto. Ralph Lauren is the ne plus ultra celebration of WASP style. Harold Coda, curator of the Costume Institute at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, called Lauren, born Ralph Lifshitz to a Jewish immigrant from Belarus, the greatest ambassador of American style. The quintessential American garment, blue jeans, was invented by Jewish immigrant Levi Strauss. Another tribute to America's British roots is the profusion of American Jews with adopted Anglo-Saxon names, like John Stewart, David Gregory, Lorne Michaels, and of course Ralph Lauren himself. Hollywood is the only major American industry that was largely built by immigrants. Jewish directors, writers, and producers celebrated their new country with wildly patriotic films, such as The Yankee Clipper, Rally Round the Flag Boys, and Plymouth Adventure. A big part of their patriotism was the reverence they exhibited for specifically WASP America. Scores of movies were set in Connecticut. Christmas in Connecticut, Holiday Inn, The Talk of the Town, Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, as well as other WASP redoubts, such as Newport, Boston, Vermont, and Mainline Philadelphia. Bing Crosby, Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, Donna Reed, and Spencer Tracy were all uber-WASP inventions of the Jews. Jewish immigrant Irving Berlin wrote God Bless America, White Christmas, Easter Parade, and This is the Army. Try to imagine an immigrant in La Raza doing any of that. Nearly all immigrants who arrived before Teddy Kennedy's Immigration Act were like this. America used to get educated, westernized immigrants who assimilated with relative ease, as Margaret Talbot put it in The New Republic, referring specifically to Muslims. Today, instead of educated Lebanese and Iranian Muslims, we're getting Muslim refugees from tribal societies in Afghanistan and Pakistan, thunderstruck by indoor plumbing. Stage 1. Make it harder for immigrants to assimilate by admitting only those from cultures wildly divergent from ours. Stage 2. Stop asking immigrants to assimilate. Stage 3. It is hate speech to ask them to assimilate. It's still possible to meet a Honduran or Bosnian immigrant more completely imbued with Anglo-Saxon values than a 10th-generation American WASP. But they're the exception. To keep bringing in waves of foreigners hostile to the native population in hopes of getting a few good ones is like draining the ocean to find a ring you lost. Diversity, that culture you risked your life to flee from. The companion lie to the America is a nation of immigrants lie is diversity is a strength. Praising diversity is simply part of the PC dogma, a mantra constantly being pounded into our heads. Repeat after me, diversity is a strength, diversity is a strength, diversity is a strength. It's like the shrieking radios permanently attached to bright people's ears in the Kurt Vonnegut story, Harrison Bergeron, to prevent them from using their superior intelligence. Contrary to everything you've heard, never in recorded history has diversity been anything but a disaster. Look at Ireland with its Protestant and Catholic populations, Canada with its French and English populations, Israel with its Jewish and Palestinian populations. Or consider the warring factions in India, Sri Lanka, China, Iraq, Czechoslovakia, until it happily split up, the Balkans and Chechnya. Also review the festering hotbeds of tribal warfare, I mean the beautiful mosaic, in third world disasters like Afghanistan, Rwanda, and South Central LA. If diversity is their strength, I'd hate to see what their weakness is. The fact that we have to be incessantly told how wonderful diversity is only proves that it's not. It's like listening to a waiter try to palm off the fish special on you before it goes bad. In response to the wanton slaughter of 13 American troops at Fort Hood by a disgruntled second-generation Muslim immigrant, Army Major Nadal Malik Hassan, Army Chief of Staff General George Casey went on Meet the Press and said, "Our diversity, not only in our Army, but in our country, is a strength." Then a few years later, after two Chechen immigrants bombed the Boston Marathon, former CIA Director Michael Hayden told a Fox News Sunday panel, "We welcome these kinds of folks coming to the United States." Really? The kind that launch murderous attacks on Americans? Do people even listen to themselves when they spout these bromides, or is it just background music? Saying he was speaking, as the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Hayden added, "Immigration to this country contributes to our national security." The 9/11 attacks must have been fantastic for national security. Hayden also made the strange announcement that America is required to look like the world. Is that in the CIA charter? I know it's in the Democratic Party's platform and also in the wedding vows of John Kerry and Theresa Heintz. This wasn't some nut from the ACLU. It was a former government official, the head of the CIA. At least it becomes less of a mystery why no one at the CIA saw 9/11 coming. A few days later on MSNBC, Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff of California responded to Muslim immigrants bombing the Boston Marathon by saying, "The American Muslim community is a source of great strength to us. Our strength in America has always been our diversity." Do these people have a silicone chip in their brains that makes them say that? How about a rousing chorus of, "Four legs good, two legs bad"? This is the sort of brainwashing Americans are relentlessly subjected to, day after day, from every major news outlet. The good news is, even after years of wall-to-wall propaganda, Americans still aren't sold on the idea. Immigrants, you're not black. Americans used to talk about integration. Then one day, out of the blue, the word integration got replaced with diversity. Just like global warming suddenly became climate change, then July. Integration was about redressing historic wrongs done to black America. Diversity isn't. Under the diversity regime, everyone gets special rights and privileges except white men. Affirmative action, welfare, enterprise zones, minority set-asides. All these used to be justified by the legacy of oppression, It all goes back to the Middle Passage. But now we're talking about social welfare being dispensed in great heaping portions to Hmong, Somalis, and Latin Americans. They arrived circa 1997. So now liberals act as if they never mentioned anything about the redress of historic grievances. The entire edifice of civil rights and discrimination law was meant to address the black experience in America, not to reward any loser with resentments. The idea was, okay, we've got 10% of the population that got the short end of the stick for a couple of centuries, so we're spending it all on them. America altered constitutional provisions about private property and freedom of contract for blacks. Huge social welfare programs were established for blacks. Affirmative action policies and racial quotas were developed for blacks. We agreed to virtually criminalize the use of certain words for blacks. Are you seeing the pattern? There's no justification for civil rights laws without blacks. But under the diversity regime, parasites from the entire world came in and announced, here's a new agenda for the civil rights movement, and it doesn't include you, Black America. After pretending to care about black people for approximately 6 minutes, Democrats ran off and redefined civil rights as the right to get an abortion, the right for a lesbian to take her date to her high school prom, and the right of foreigners to vote in America on ballots printed in their native language. And thus ended the brief era of liberals pretending to care about black people. At least lesbians and the abortion ladies are American lesbians and American abortion ladies. Without reason, the left has appropriated the black experience in America and given it away to foreigners. But they'll never pay a price for it because African Americans still block vote for the Democrats. It's understandable that Democrats would want to dump integration the first chance they got. Democrats could never accept the fact that civil rights was about correcting specific and severe injustices done to American blacks, principally because they were the ones who had perpetrated the injustice.